You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
And she is Jenna Burrell, assistant professor at the School of Information at UC Berkeley. For those of you who don't know the iSchool at Berkeley, it's this sort of marvelously interdisciplinary, somewhat Berkman-like in its setup department, featuring folks whose work is more grounded in sociology and also ethnography to a certain extent. Jenna wrote what is at this point the best book on figuring out how computers are actually used in contemporary Ghana, a wonderful book called Invisible Users, which looks at not just culture within Ghana's cyber cafes, but also questions of computer recycling and sort of the whole supply chain associated with computers in that wonderful, interesting, and perpetually surprising country. She's done work with Intel, which is a company that is surprisingly grounded in the social sciences, in their research about how people work with technology, went on to do a doctorate in sociology at the London School of Economics, and is working on a wide variety of very interesting projects that sort of look at questions of how people actually use technology versus how we think they use technology, and how those preconceptions about how we think people use technology sometimes put up barriers to how people actually do use technology. So, thrilled that you could be with us at Berkman, and really looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Great. Thanks for the introduction, Ethan. And, thanks for the Berkman Center for having me. I'm doing kind of the tour of Boston this week since I teach, and so I'm kind of stuck on the West Coast most of the time, but I cleared out this week to try and meet with people, and it's been long been a plan of mine to come to the Berkman Center and check out what was going on here and talk to people. The title of my talk, as advertised, was basically the title of my book, Invisible Users, Youth in the Internet Cafes of Urban Ghana. But for this particular audience, I actually wanted to talk about some things that I arrived at in the conclusion of my book. So I've retitled it Network Security and Preserving Access in the Margins of the Global Internet. So I wrote this book. It took many years. I started the research in 2004. My first trip to Ghana was 2004. I was there for 9 months. I went back periodically for a period of 6 years. And I observed some things that sort of changed and evolved in terms of access to internet resources in that country in that 6 year period, which I want to talk about today. So the end point of the book and some of the things I talked about in the conclusion seemed to suggest to me maybe some new areas for research that I'm thinking about delving into, and I'm hoping to use this audience to kind of flesh out this space. And I'm already thinking that maybe network security is a little too narrow to a way to bound the area that of interest for this particular issue of access in the margins. So ethnography, I'm an ethnographer. Ethnography is sort of famous or infamous for its micro-focus. So, you know, the title of my book is Youth in the Internet Cafes of Urban Ghana. I posted an announcement on Facebook, and one of my old friends said, oh, that's so funny, because I just finished a book on youth in the internet cafes of suburban Ghana. You know, but of course, you know, it's easy to get very immersed in that micro world in the process of doing the field work. But then in writing a book, I had to, and I wanted to kind of step back and think about what angle studying the internet from a place like Ghana was giving me on our broader understanding of the global internet. And I think that's something that's sort of profoundly interesting about the way the internet is shaping up. It is ever more truly becoming global. You have people connecting from ever more marginal parts of the world. And I'll try to talk about and clarify what I mean by marginal. So what does that mean? There was this very early conversation about the internet that often used terms like cyberspace and cyberculture, and attributed a lot of promise to what the internet would be for a global society. And this promise often stemmed from this idea that when we go online, we escape the constraints of our bodily existence, right? We can travel distances that are very difficult or expensive to do in person, and we can shed our kind of bodily exteriors, our race, our gender, these aspects of identity that people may judge us by. That conversation sort of died down. I think it became unfashionable, and I actually think it became unfashionable just at the time when we can actually start holding those ideals to account and asking questions about whether they have proven to be true when we now have an internet where people from very different backgrounds and different parts of the world are interacting. So in Ghana in particular, I didn't know what I was going to find in the internet cafes when I sort of stumbled into these spaces, but it turned out to be sort of ideal for raising those kinds of questions because, I'm actually just going to skip this slide, but what I found was really a driving force for young people in internet cafes was connecting with abroad, connecting with people abroad, making foreign connections. So doing this challenging work of trying to communicate across cultural boundaries. I think in other parts of the world, I wouldn't have found that sort of impulse. So the word that was often used was pen pals, and I have to sort of contextualize this. I added this little in parentheses that this is about the internet circa 2005 in Ghana. And it's not all Ghanaians, it's this particular group of non-elite youth who are accessing the internet principally from these cafes. So there's a separate segment of Ghanaian society. I have a student who calls it the Ghanaian digerati. So the more elite Ghanaians who are maybe involved in programming and the open source movement, who have some mobility, can travel abroad, university educated. That was not the population that I was talking to. I was talking to young people who were not, certainly not the poorest of the poor, but they were sort of a separate population, often that had a certain amount of high school education, were English literate to varying degrees, and often had stopped their education at a point that, you know, that they had to when they ran out of the funds to support their education. So they're non-elite, but they're not certainly not the poorest of the poor. So that group talked about the internet as a place where they could find pen pals. And one thing that is interesting about this is that it just illustrates how technology comes to be understood through analogy. So young people had experience with, you know, writing letters to foreign pen pals, paper and pen, and that analogy was brought to understanding what the internet might be. So going into the internet cafes, a driving impulse was to find pen pals and looking on dating websites, looking on pen pal websites. Yahoo chat rooms were extremely popular. A lot of this has changed, but this was the sort of initial impulse for this group of young people going to the internet for the first time was to make foreign connections. And I've bulleted pen pals, I think we assume that means same-aged peers, other people in school, but actually that term encompassed a broader set of relationships for the young Ghanaians I talked to. So it could be friends, it could be someone that you might develop a romantic interest in, it could be someone older who might provide patronage or sponsorship for your education, it could be a potential business partner, a philanthropist, it was really anyone that you could find who might not only become a friend and sort of a partner in cultural exchange, but sometimes provide perhaps more instrumental support. And there were very mixed experiences with attempting to do that. It wasn't a completely misguided practice. I saw people who actually succeeded in getting sponsorship and support, finding a spouse, for example. All of those things happened. But to give you a sense of the range, because included in this sort of category of pen pals, you know, as an extension of it, there are also practices of internet scamming that sort of follow the same strategy, finding foreign connections and exploiting them. So to give you a sense of that full range, I have a couple of quotes. So this is one Ghanaian internet user who I spent a lot of time with in Accra, who said he usually liked to go to Yahoo chat rooms because that was where he found more moral people. But it was sort of a mixed bag experience. So you can find very boring people, and you can also find very good people, which was the goal. But he was struggling with this kind of conversation conversational approach in the Christian chat room. He really wasn't there to sort of discuss the Bible or, you know, think deep theological thoughts. He was there to network. And so the conversation was sort of getting in the way. So he points to this struggle. He says, I have a mission, and they're talking about a subject. My mission is to meet people. I mean, real people, like friends, make friends, people I can team up with to get my NGO done, or people, you know, maybe a marriage opportunity, right? So a full range of possible relationships might be encountered in this Christian chat room. And he was open to any possibility, basically. Okay, now here's a more kind of cynical approach, and the word pen pals is used. So this is an internet scammer who said, I take pen pals just for the exchange of items. And actually, I don't take my size. I have to explain what that means, I've learned. So in Ghana, size is a proxy for status. So a big man is someone who probably is physically large, but also high status, wealthy, you know, a minister in the government, etc. And a small boy is someone who's low status and young and probably smaller in size. So he says, I don't take my size, meaning he tries to take higher status people. I take sugar mommies and sugar daddies because if you take your size, they're unemployed. So if you ask them for something which is very huge, they won't get it for you. Okay, so that's like sort of the range, the spectrum of approaches to finding friends and searching for pen pals. In Yahoo chat rooms. I want to give just three examples of how this plays out and sometimes how it went wrong. So this is my very favorite example. There was a youth club that I met who was using the internet cafe. There were four of them. The young man I interviewed was named, I'm calling him Kwaku. They went online to the British Airways website and they found the frequent flyer miles program, which was called the Executive Club, and they ordered membership cards, which they received. And so they decided to call themselves the Executive Club. And there wasn't ever an intention to use these membership cards to book flights, though they were pleased to learn that there were benefits. You could, you know, book charter flights, etc. They also would do things online, like try to get free Bibles and CDs. And the competition was basically about getting as much of that material from abroad as possible. And it, you know, it reflects a very kind of playful attitude towards this kind of foreign connection practice. You know, just getting something with your name and address that's been sent from a very distant place as a sort of kind of extension of personal power was the joy in it. So that's just an example of sort of the playfulness in this kind of practice. This particular example doesn't involve actually making connections with individuals or connecting to foreigners, but the next example does. So there's a young woman I spent time with who I'm calling Fauzia. She had a long-standing relationship. I mean, I'm not sure how long-standing, maybe a few weeks, but she was recurringly chatting on Yahoo, Yahoo chat with a man who they had started to develop a real rapport. They were talking almost every day. They would flash each other's phones. Like, it was expensive to actually talk on the phone, but just to kind of underline their connection, they would call and make the other person's phone ring, you know, another kind of channel for building that connection. And after a period of time, she made what she thought was a very small request. She asked for a small favor, which was that her phone had been having problems, and she asked him if he would send her a mobile phone. And he never spoke to her again. And actually, this sort of immediate exclusion and shunning was something that I heard a lot about from the young Ghanaians that I talked to who were trying to make these foreign connections. So he disappeared. There's this sort of dance of avoidance that would sometimes happen. They'd come online, and she would try to chat with him, and he would go offline, right? So it was basically just a very immediate and total avoidance after that request. And usually, in the experience of young Ghanaians I talked to, it was after a request for a gift or money, which they just didn't understand. It was a small amount of money. It was a small gift. They would continue to communicate with this person if they didn't send it. So it underlines a sort of problems of mutual intelligibility in the interactional space of these online environments. And then a third example is, another person I'm calling Kwaku. I've been doubling up my pseudonyms. I sat and watched a young man. He was doing some of this more instrumentalist work that's borders. I don't call it scamming, but it's much less about building relationships and more about getting some kind of gain. So I sat and watched him use the internet. He was trying to get an invitation to get a travel visa. And he happened to be talking to a woman from Poland. And she was, you know, playing along and kind of talking to him about this. And he was saying, okay, when I arrive, can I stay in your house? And she said, no, you can't stay in my house. And it just did not make sense to him. And he said, well, you know, I know Europeans are sometimes racist, so maybe that's the reason that she won't let me stay in her house, because she's prejudiced against black people or Africans. Okay, so three examples. To underline this point, and this sets up a few things that I wanted to talk about as far as network security, the challenges of this intercultural space. Not everyone's doing these kinds of interactions online, seeking to talk with people who are from very different social experiences. But in the case of these young Ghanaians who are, there's this real struggle to deal with the sort of cultural discontinuity of online spaces. So there are both divergent baseline understandings about things like requests. There's a sort of a Ghanaian moral economy of gifting. It's very normal and perfectly polite to ask your friends for a little money. There's a principle of reciprocity for a small gift. That sort of division that we often perform in the Western world between purely social relationships and purely economic relationships is a very Western practice. And it's much more fuzzy among the way young Ghanaians relate to one another. So those requests seem very innocent and seem to be interpreted by the foreigners, the Westerners they were communicating with, as some sort of offense. There are also differences in sort of gender norms. So one practice of scamming that was very common was for young men to pretend to be women and try and find a foreign man who would be their boyfriend. And the assumption was that once you had a boyfriend, of course he would send you money. That's what you do when you're in a relationship. You get money from your significant other. And that wasn't necessarily a norm that was understood by the people they were communicating with. And then also norms of obligation and hospitality. So if your cousin comes from the village to the city, he stays in your house. If you have one bed, you share the bed. Why, if I travel to Poland, would it be such a big deal for me to stay in this lady's house? You know, these ideas about how you treat one another, baseline understandings about hospitality, gifting, you know, gender norms were different between the young Ghanaians who were going online and the people they were communicating with, and that just wasn't understood on either side. And then on top of that, that's complicated by a couple of factors. One is that young Ghanaians were connecting to the internet. They're basically paying per minute or per hour for that connection. And so they might not normally jump straight to a request for a travel visa or a small gift or money, but they were paying for that connection and didn't have the time to sort of build those relationships as they might normally. And then finally, there were certainly on both sides some simplistic perceptions by Westerners of Africa and some simplistic perceptions among young Ghanaians about Westerners and their degree of affluence. So an assumption that the people they were communicating with by virtue of being in America or in Europe were affluent. I think in the case of the Polish woman, that was, you know, she was trying to convince him that she didn't have money and resources available for things like helping him come to Poland, and it was hard to communicate that. Okay, so this is sort of the setup just to try and give you a sense of the complicatedness of these online interactions and how much of this is really very much cultural. And what I want to move to, so I think in the example of Fauzia, you know, you're talking about a relationship where whoever she was talking to decided that she wasn't, you know, someone he wanted to communicate with anymore. We have all these features now that you can use on Facebook and anywhere else to block someone, right? So you can ban someone from your online network. It's a very kind of unique possibility in online spaces. You know, if you're in a face-to-face environment, in a social environment where there's someone you have a problem with, there's not really a way to pick them up and just drop them out of your social universe, right? I think what's interesting about this possibility of blocking and banning people is that it hits up against some of this discourse about the ideals and possibilities of the internet, that it would be this space of tolerance, right? And social inclusion, that we go online and we shed our bodily exteriors and we just relate to one another, you know, one-to-one through language and communication. I think the fact that we have these features sort of belies that reality, right? It doesn't show a lot of tolerance to be able to take someone who slightly offends you and kind of eliminate them from your online environment permanently. But the thing that concerns me more is that what I've observed in certain online sites, so for example, dating websites, is that moving beyond the block and ban features, there are now practices that are actually blocking certain parts of the world entirely from access, especially dating websites often block countries like Ghana and Nigeria entirely. So if there's not really an effort to weed out scammers from non-scammers, but just that's a group of people who aren't behaving in the dating site in the way that's expected or desired. And so as a whole, they're being blocked from access to those resources. So shift from block and ban features to what I'm calling encoded exclusion. Okay, so I have, you know, in the kind of realm of network security, I have a couple of distinctions I want to make. I want to talk about, first of all, practices of failing to include, which are perhaps unintentional and not necessarily targeted at countries like Ghana. And then I want to talk about purposeful exclusion. And some of what I'm talking about, you know, this is perhaps a new research direction for me, so it's not the effort of a lot of very careful systematic research. This is just sort of an initial distinction. Some of it comes from my own experiences trying to do the things I normally do on the internet in the U.S., but when I'm physically located in Ghana, and some of the barriers I hit up against. So in the category of failure to include, I think the entire realm of e-commerce is basically the place to kind of think about this. The reality in Ghana, it's a cash-based economy, so people don't have credit cards. By and large, they don't have credit cards, unless we're talking about Ghanaians who have spent time abroad in countries like the U.S. and acquired a credit card while they were in one of those countries. So basically anywhere where you want to pay money for something, even if you have the money and you're in Ghana, there's just really no opportunities or routes for doing that. So I have a couple of examples. The first example is about the underwear bomber, but let me jump to the second example. So for example, Match.com is a dating website, very popular. I'm sure everyone's heard of it, that you pay a membership fee for. And the membership fee is not outrageous. And, you know, Ghanaians I know who wanted to sign up for this service had absolutely no way to do that because they didn't have credit cards. And a number of fraudsters that I talked to rationalized the use of credit card fraud to gain access because they had simply no other legitimate way to pay for that service. I just think about, you know, the whole, what's the last thing that you bought on the internet, and just having that entire realm of the internet cut off from you, having no way of doing that. That's a lot of the internet to have no access to. I have a friend, Corenting, who has a blog, great blog. He's an expat. He's Ghanaian by birth. He's lived in France and now is in the U.S. in Berkeley, where I live. And he has a great blog. He has an entry called Black Sheep, which you should go look up if you want to read a really well-stated case for this problem. And he talks about, you know, this is a great quote, I think, if we take e-commerce as one component of modern global citizenship, then we, meaning Ghanaians or people from this region of the world, are illegal aliens of sorts, and our participation is marginal at best. I'm trying to think of what I wanted to say about the underwear bomber. Now I remember. So the underwear bomber was Nigerian, but he bought the plane ticket that he, for the flight where he tried to blow himself up, he bought it in cash in Ghana. And there's something about the fact that it was in cash that seemed to resonate with the news media. I think in this society, we think, oh, cash. People, you know, trade in large sums of cash when they're doing something illegal, right? But if you're in a cash-based economy and you want to buy a computer, you're going to pay for it in cash. Or if you want to buy a plane ticket, you're going to pay for it in cash. There's nothing inherently seedy about the fact that he paid for that plane ticket in cash. But I remember watching a media report where someone from the State Department said the reason that people pay for cash, things in cash in Ghana is because of fraud. I thought, well, that's sort of a weird interpretation of what's going on there.
Is that an intentional seedy pun that you made there?
No pun intended. Someone from the State Department was basically suggesting that something about kind of the criminality of the state or the society leads to trading in cash. And I think it's much more complicated than that. It has to do with the infrastructure that's in place to, you know, monitor people's credit ratings and to grant credit to people that doesn't exist in Ghana. And I heard, you know, around that time calls for extra security screening for people who pay for tickets in cash, just kind of outrageous interpretations of what that meant and what extra security, stringent security needed to be taken on people who do that. So that's the category of failure to include. But I wanted to just spend the rest of the time talking about more purposeful forms of exclusion. So, I have a credit card. And I went to Ghana a couple years ago and did a couple of things that I would normally do. One was log into my Amazon account to order a book that I was going to ship home. I immediately got an email that said I may have been the victim of a phishing scam. And not only that, my password was immediately changed automatically, which is interesting. It was a detour. It didn't block me from using Amazon. But clearly, Amazon has set up some sort of probably IP address detection that resolves to Ghana, you know, and I mean, the network security is hard to know exactly how these things are configured because they're not supposed to be transparent. But I assume if you try to do something like that in Ghana, that's automatically the response.
They also flat out will not deliver to Ghanaian addresses, to Kenyan addresses. I don't know about Nigerian addresses. But for those of us who go regularly back and forth to sub-Saharan Africa, this is the second bag problem. If you have friends in these countries, you are Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Because there's no other way to order goods to these places.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think the perception, if you're in Ghana, is just this kind of pervasive suspicion of, you know, these you know, key services on the internet of who you are, your intentions. I also I collected all this fabric and I was going to take a sewing class. I tried to sign up for my sewing class in Oakland while I was in Ghana, and it was just plain impossible. PayPal will allow you to make payments without credit cards, but PayPal does not serve Ghana or Nigeria presumably because of security issues. And they just put me through this, you know, they said it was random, but they put me through this extended loop of checks, and in the end, I couldn't finish the purchase until I received a call on my U.S.-based phone number, and I wasn't going to be able to do that while I was in Ghana. So I just couldn't use PayPal. And then in general, what I've seen as far as this kind of evolving process, you know, since the time when I started the research in Ghana to now, proliferation of IP address blocking, just wholesale IP address blocking practices, especially on dating sites. And I know people in Ghana who legitimately represented themselves on dating sites. I even know a couple of people who found spouses that way. And you can, you know, judge the nature of their relationships. I think they're adults and they have the autonomy to decide who they want to marry and how they want to meet that person. But many sites, plentyoffish.com is the site where this woman I know met her Canadian husband. And they now state that they block all major traffic from Africa, not just Ghana and Nigeria, the whole of Africa, Romania, Turkey, India, and Russia, quote unquote, like every other major site. That's pretty extreme. I went back and checked the link and it's not up there anymore. So a lot of this is kind of, you know, appearing and disappearing. I don't know why they would remove that disclaimer from their site. Maybe they got some pushback. I don't know. But a lot of sites are not actually filtering scams or checking on scamming practices. They're just blocking certain countries in their entirety to handle security practices, which I think we need to spend more time kind of examining that practice, because clearly there are scams that originate in the U.S. and then practices of scam and spam filtering that try to distinguish between, you know, what is a scam and what is legitimate. And so just to sort of show an extreme version of this, I did a search and pulled up a bunch of quotes from different sites like webmasterworld.com, a Unix security discussion group. And so here are some of the more extreme quotes. I'm so fed up with these darn African fraudsters. Is it possible to block African traffic by IP? The whole of Africa. I'm certain that this person is having problems particular with people in particular countries, not the entirety of Africa. But just, you know, this problem that those of us who do research in Africa find, this perception that Africa is like one place, a reminder it's not a country. You know, these attempts to handle security that very much overreach their targets is illustrated well in these quotes. So the second point, maybe we could just disconnect those countries from the internet until they get their scam artists under control. And then, you know, finally reflecting some of what's at the base of this, commercial interest, which is not super surprising, right? I administer an e-commerce website, and a lot of bogus traffic comes from countries that do not offer much in commercial value. So they're not going to buy stuff from us. We just don't need to have them even have any kind of access to the site. Actually, along those lines, I happened to go to the website for West Elm, the furniture store in Ghana, and not only did it not let me shop, which was not surprising, it wouldn't even let me look at the site. It said, in your geography, based on your geography, you can't have access to the site. So I can't even look at couches and chairs and tables because I don't have the capacity they imagine to purchase furniture. So overreaching measures to handle security issues or reflecting commercial interests. Okay, so I have just a couple more slides. One, I wanted to sort of point back to the reality that there are certainly issues with scamming originating in Ghana. That's not a made-up problem. And just to think a little bit about what role national governments have in this global internet and its accessibility. So I went back and looked at John Perry Barlow's old Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, which took a very extreme stance, 1996, right? You know, asking the governments of the industrial world, I underlined industrial world because it's just interesting that he didn't even imagine that any other part of the world would need to be addressed. But governments of the industrial world, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You're not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. You know, this hope of a space that could escape government intervention and surveillance and intrusion. Certainly, part of the problem with Ghanaian scamming is that there's not an effective crackdown in Ghana on scamming activities. Why that's the case is not, there's not a super simple answer. So I spent some time with a British woman who'd been scammed out of $100,000 and had come to Ghana to pursue her case through the court system. So I went to court with her. And there is certainly from her, from what I observed, what she experienced, and from talking to scammers, there is some concern about the Ghanaian police being kind of bought to overlook scams. What I saw in the courts was a great deal of genuine interest among, you know, the judges, the lawyers, in trying to crack down on this activity. So it's not the case that, you know, the Ghanaian government is corrupt, period, and they're just letting scamming happen. It's more complicated than that. But in the end, there is not yet an effective crackdown on scamming activities by the Ghanaian government. And that has consequences, of course, for Ghanaian citizens who are not scammers, who are trying to get access to the internet and who are being thrown in with this pool of people doing things that are illegitimate or harmful. So, just pointing to sort of the consequentiality of national governments and their significance in addition to kind of how network security is practiced, from global centers, also how governments are able to ensure that their citizenry have access to the internet is a question to think about as well. Okay, so final thoughts. And these are some questions that I'm starting to think about and wondering about whether there's a research project to undertake in this direction. The first is, I don't know how much in network security circles there's a discussion about inclusiveness. I mean, there's certainly discussion about correctly identifying malicious behavior and stopping it, but I'm not sure if there's, you know, as a complement to that, a discussion about inclusiveness, especially inclusiveness of people connecting from parts of the world that don't offer a lot of commercial value, or aren't well understood, or that don't have large populations connecting and making their voices heard in these online spaces. So one question is, where is that discussion happening, if it is? A second question is about how do we actually figure out? I mean, I did some Google searching. I had some personal experiences. But how do we find out what are the consequences of network security practices in the global margins? How do we sort of specify what's happening and the extent of IP address blocking, for example? You know, I run across it here and there. Is that a widespread practice? And is, you know, are those kinds of overreaching measures justified? I think probably there are cases where they are, but that's a question. I'm not sure that question's even being asked. It's often, you know, network administrators of this or that website making a decision about what would be the most kind of simple, easy way to manage a problem, and as a consequence, blocking off huge portions of the world from accessing, you know, the internet's many, many nodes. So those are the final thoughts I have. I guess I'll probably go back to that, but I'm ready for conversations and discussion. This is the book. If you're interested in reading more, it's not really about network security. It's about cyber culture, or you know, Ghana's cyber culture and how
it's totally awesome, and I even say so on the back of the book.
Yes, Ethan was one of my blurb writers, and I'm on Twitter and I have a website. So
let's open a conversation on this, because you've done us a great favor of both giving us a very helpful background on how Ghanaian culture, in particular Ghanaian cyber culture, can lead to some of these misunderstandings. But now there's also these very interesting questions about sort of a global network administration culture and how it might be misunderstanding or understanding correctly and frankly not caring about some of the behavioral consequences, which brings us into territory that's not unfamiliar for a lot of people around this table, around issues of censorship, around issues of internet accessibility. So I'm interested in what this is sparking for folks. I know that Kendra has already jumped up to get a hand up early on, and we'll get around the room because I know that people are psyched about this. But
I will
Kendra,
keep
lead us
this
off.
Really brief. I think at the beginning you mentioned that you weren't sure if network security was the right term, and I second maybe the your thought that it isn't quite the right way to frame it, because I think that often, like, fraud isn't, you know, it's a problem that people deal with in the context of security, but that isn't, you know, necessarily a network security issue in a formal sense. And it's sort of maybe underselling the impacts of this on the communities and on the websites to say, like, oh, this is a network security issue, as opposed to, like, I just seconding that the framing, you may want to frame it more broadly.
Peggy?
Okay. I think I appreciate the presentation, one, because it definitely, I can relate to it as a Nigerian, and most of the things that were said actually also happens in Nigeria and quite a number of other African countries. But I think also in our part of the globe, there are certain things that people tend to view differently, and you mentioned about the cultural discontinuities. You know, for instance, like age, people don't usually feel, you know, open to talk about their age. And then when you have like sites that predated Facebook, like 360 on Yahoo, you know, people don't want to put their original age, where they live, and these other information. So the amount of personal information that people need to put online also, you know, sort of restrict them in terms of how they are, you know, is also considered on how they use the internet. I didn't see that. I thought I should mention it. And then about e-commerce, apart from the fraud aspects, it also, you know, borders on people wanting to let other people know, or either government agencies or institutions know how much they spend or how they spend their money or how they, you know, deal with financial issues. People definitely, and that's why it's always almost difficult for government to impose the e-commerce governance on people and how people deal with carrying cash out. You know, around, and it's huge. I think Ghana is even moderate compared to Nigeria, where, you know, people move, like, you know, thousands of dollars in cash, liquid cash in Naira, you know, about in sacks, you know, in their vehicles. And sometimes you even just, you can't write check for people to go to banks. And these are some of the things that are uniquely African. I don't know how, you know, that will be surmounted. And people seem to have, you know, this sort of hangover on these cultural aspects, and they are not changing. And yes, Africa is not a country, but you also need to disaggregate, you know, sometimes, because what you have is some of the sites that usually will not allow you to buy from Ghana. Now, perhaps Ghana has been elevated and it's, you know, gained some credibility. Nigeria is still, like, I think recently, just last year, was when Apple, you know, included Nigeria on the list of those countries that you could register from, you know, if you buy a new Apple product. And Nigerians are, like, huge. They have huge, you know, customer base in Nigeria. But what people then do, you know, in terms of these restrictions, is that they move from place to place. So you have a lot of Nigerians moving into Ghana. And when, you know, urban Ghana becomes, you know, in terms of locating those who are doing this and the IP addresses, then they move to rural communities where sometimes it's difficult to track them. So there's all these, and places needs to be disaggregated too, to be able to really discuss the issue of Africa not being, you know, being a country. And in terms of scamming and whether government is tracking them down, it seems to me that government is rather reactive, you know, to people's, citizens' usage of, you know, the internet, you know, and sometimes, you know, the citizens have adopted this new internet, new technology, and they're already using it widely before government then begins to try to put certain, you know, schemes or, you know, policies in place to track, you know, and it becomes difficult because already this is proliferated and, you know, already penetrated into, you know, the society. So government then have, you know, a lot of difficulty in terms of control and others. Yeah. Thought I should mention this point.
It seems like there haven't really been questions, but some really valuable comments.
We'll take a question and or comment here. And
yeah.
We'll...
So it's a kind of a question and a comment. So this is really fascinating, and I actually wasn't really aware of the practice of blocking that was going on from Western internet entities towards Africa as a whole, and targeting specific countries in some cases. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of information resource that lists these, the companies or the websites that do this. And this made me think a lot about Verdict, actually, because it's a form of censorship. And, you know, Verdict, of course, is actually getting people to kind of say, I tried to access this website, but I couldn't do it. You know, is blocked in some way, and I'm wondering if there's anything like that. Perhaps even Verdict would be applicable in this case, and I'm just missing it. But as perhaps a way to kind of make Westerners aware of what's going on, what's being done by their own companies towards Africa in some context, because I feel like there's perhaps just not enough pressure from people who might think that this was objectionable because they simply don't know that it's going.
Yeah. And I mean, that was what was eye-opening for me is it wasn't something I observed when I first was in Ghana, but with some return trips, all of a sudden I was hitting these barriers that you just don't see them if you're in the U.S. because they're country specific. But what was the name of the site? I haven't
heard it.
So Verdict is a very proud Berkman project. There's
okay.
A lot of people in the room involved with this, but it's been a way of trying to crowdsource reports of internet censorship, usually as a way of trying to say, oh, look, the Vietnamese government is blocking access to Facebook again.
Yeah.
But the possibility that as more sophisticated users use a tool like Verdict, they might be able to document different forms of blockage, like Amazon gives me an enormous runaround and ultimately won't let me ship to a Ghanaian address.
Yeah. What's the, how do you spell that?
H-E-R-D-I-C-T.
Okay. Oh, I guess, I guess correctly.
Verdict of the herd.
Oh, I get it. Okay.
Posited by Professor Jonathan Zittrain.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, I think this is sort of in that same vein of concerning practice. It, you know, often when we're talking about barriers, it's usually national governments blocking their citizenry. And so here we're talking about blocking, but it's Western kind of network centers blocking global peripheries for different motives, but
I'm Ryan, and I run the Herdic Project.
Great.
So I just can follow Ross right on that. And I think, you know, the point is, I think, good in that, you know, Herdic could definitely be used in that kind of way because it's not just focused on governments imposing censorship. It's trying to ask the question, what can't people reach and from where, and trying to collect data on that to paint a, you know, sort of real-time picture of what the Internet looks like. And, you know, one thing I will say is that we do not get very many reports from Africa, you know, because it's crowdsourced. We're entirely dependent on where people are aware of what we do, and while we've gotten a lot of reports from Vietnam and Middle East, China, Africa has sort of been a big blind spot, and, you know, if there's, you know, any way that it can be leveraged to get more information and to help people in places like Ghana communicate about what they can and can't access, that would be great. And I do have a question there to follow up on that.
Just on that very quickly, Ryan, Egghead Ryan, I mean, if you want Nigerian users of Herdic, I mean, that should not be problematic.
Yeah. But my one question is, you know, and this I think ties in with the censorship thing, is that in countries where there's government censorship, oftentimes there's a culture of circumvention that comes around it. So people use VPNs to get around IP address blocking, things like that. So I was wondering if that's something that's commonly done in Ghana, or whether that's more of a trait of the digerati.
I've sat next to scammers and watched them try to route around these. You know, they would tell me they do. They're able to configure. I don't actually believe this is true, but they're able to configure in their web browser a way to do IP address spoofing. And I don't think you can do that from a web browser through a simple available configuration. I don't know.
Not very well.
Yeah. So so in order to do some of this very kind of clearly illegitimate activity, like scamming people on dating websites, I've watched scammers kind of jump from site to site and open profiles and try to get email addresses and try to kind of move through these spaces really quickly. There are a lot of dating websites, and some talk about IP address spoofing. But among, you know, these non-elite users who are trying to do legitimate things, I have not seen that kind of culture of circumvention emerge. What I've seen is a certain amount of disillusionment. And I actually wrote a paper following up with 12 of my best kind of key informants who were doing the broadest spectrum of things on the Internet, following up 6 years later to find out what they were doing on the Internet. And most of them were not really using the Internet anymore. And some of it was not that they were blocked from dating websites, but some of these problems with cross-cultural interaction that they could never kind of figure out how to overcome. So it was more likely for them to just give up on those practices. One thing that has changed is that a lot of Ghanaians are doing Facebook and perhaps interacting with other Ghanaians more than foreigners as they used to, and networking maybe with the diaspora, which, you know, the kind of terms of understanding are a little more common among that larger group. But I didn't see them figuring out these strategies of circumvention. I expect among the digerati you would find that.
Or, I'm just wondering rhetorically, you may have already picked up on this, but have you ever thought about applying the term redlining to this kind of country?
Yes, that is incredibly prescient. So I actually have a student who's in the African American Studies program at Berkeley, who he used that word, and I was like, that's brilliant. That is exactly a great word and a great practice to explore as an analogy, and I think it's very appropriate.
Cyber redlining might be a very catchy way to
Right.
understand.
Yes.
So as you're talking, I started thinking about this concept of exclusion and about the multi-directionality of it, and the idea that here you're talking a lot about exclusion, you know, coming from the U.S. or coming from developed countries and going towards Africa. But then I was thinking of my work in China and thinking of how many times I encountered things within China that blocked me as an American from getting online. Just like, so World of Warcraft, you have to have a Chinese ID to get on the Chinese server. And, you know, they only use Chinese credit cards. You can't use an international credit card and all of this. And I wondered if you encountered any of that kind of exclusion within your fieldwork in Ghana. Like, did you have examples of being in Ghana where it was set up for a Ghanaian system that didn't accept a system from abroad? And I was just thinking that's like sort of a way to problematize this
yeah.
more.
Well, I think what we're getting to are some pretty significant differences in government. So the Ghanaian government really doesn't have the resources, I think, to be enforcing an infrastructure of like Ghanaian ID systems for online resources. That I haven't seen anything like that personally. But I mean, it doesn't surprise me that you would see it in China.
Right.
Much larger, more kind of intrusive state.
Where you might bump into it accidentally is in Kenya, where e-payment systems are now common enough that in some circles, not having M-Pesa on your phone is somewhat limiting. And enabling M-Pesa on your phone is actually surprisingly complicated, because suddenly you have the ability to do cashless transactions, which means they want verification of your SIM card, authentication to a passport, and it's a very high degree of authentication. And it took me a good week to sort of get up and running on it in that sense of being excluded. But, you know, again, sort of dealing with a somewhat more intricate state apparatus.
There are the new practices of SIM card registration, which, I mean, has seemed to be, for me, perfectly accessible. I register my SIM card in Ghana because if you don't, they turn off your phone number. And actually, though, I often have my research assistant registered in his name so I can come back and use the same SIM number when I return. So I guess that's maybe the best the closest example I can think of.
Yes, please.
I think we're drawing this analogy between censorship and a company choosing not to provide a paid service. And I'm curious I'm not convinced that that's a fair analogy to draw. I mean, is it really, I'm not convinced, for instance, that a company should be compelled to do business in a country where there isn't a legal infrastructure to protect it, in the case of transactions that are fraudulent. And it seems like that the issues that we talk about when we talk about censorship, people having access to all the ideas that are out there, and all those kind of classic John Stuart Mill type arguments, I'm not sure that necessarily applies when it comes to commerce. So I don't know if I realize that's more of a statement than a question, but is that kind of, I wonder if you could kind of elaborate on that analogy and whether or not you think it's reasonable.
It seems like a question that, or a statement that has resonated. I totally see what you mean. And, you know, going back to the beginning of the internet, it has always been possible to have like a password protected or an invite only community and to disallow. I mean, not everything on the internet early on was necessarily accessible to everyone. That gets to this challenge of the commercialization of the internet, which I'm sure everyone, well, maybe not everyone here, but many of us here have been thinking about. And I mean, the whole network neutrality debate relates to this transition from a kind of public, academically supported, government-supported service to something that's very commercial. And it's a totally legitimate question. But when we talk about some of these fundamental tools, Google search, or the ability to buy something and to turn that over wholly to, you know, whatever commerce considers in its best interest, I think probably a lot of people have some questions about whether that is just something to throw our hands up about or something to push back against.
So here's a complicating analogy that we were talking about before this talk. Facebook has introduced a number of lightweight interfaces designed for the developing world. So you can go to a lighter weight, thinner version of Facebook for Nigeria, where there's a massive population of Facebook users. And one way you could view this is, wow, that's thoughtful. It's great that Facebook is trying to find a low bandwidth way of accommodating its Nigerian users. The flip side to this is every user costs Facebook a certain amount. And generally speaking, ad clicks from Nigeria are not as valuable to Facebook as ad clicks from the US because people aren't going ahead and doing these purchases after the fact. So one might view this as a way of Facebook essentially saying, how do we cut our losses for customers who are not likely to generate a lot of revenue for us, and can we provide thinner levels of service? Now, I might make the argument that if we're going to turn on Mill or such, that having digital public spaces, which for better or for worse, are commercial spaces at this point, becomes extremely problematic if those spaces become redlined in one fashion so that you're not able to get as full access to that space if you're coming from undesirable corners of the internet. So, you know, open question about whether, you know, Facebook will at some point say that they're going to degrade performance for these areas, but they have taken steps that already move in a direction of limiting photos, limiting video for those users, presumably under the header of appropriate technology, but very easy to look at and sort of say, if Facebook has no commercial interest in serving Nigerian users, will they continue to serve them in the same way they serve U.S. users? So I'm going to jump back into the queue here.
Actually, my question was very similar to that. When I was in Guinea, something that I noticed was not necessarily this intentional blocking, although I didn't look at that as well as you have, but something that struck me was this kind of unintentional restricted use, basically because, you know, a lot of websites, especially related to getting access to information, I was teaching forestry, and there's information about this from so many organizations all over the world, but the problem is that they're writing code and they're using these programs for a much faster internet speed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so just based on the fact that in a lot of places speed was just so slow, it just wasn't even worth it to get on these sites. So I don't know, have you encountered that and gone at
it? Yes, and actually, I mean, I kind of categorize that under failure to include. I mean, there's all this push towards cloud computing. You have a piece of software like Windows, and it pushes Windows updates to your computer when necessary. And those updates can be incredibly large. And if you're you have a computer in Ghana, you probably turn it off because it's going to disrupt your network service. It's going to cost you a lot of money to download that many megabytes. You're paying per megabyte. And so it's essentially that. I think the shift to cloud computing and network, you know, services rather than software is really problematic for parts of the world that have low bandwidth connections or pay per minute. And I don't think anyone's thinking about that when they're, you know, the shift is very much centered in high bandwidth countries where people don't pay per minute. And the ramifications are difficult for countries in the periphery.
True.
Along the same lines, I will try and be brief about the e-commerce kind of thing. I think this is a really challenging issue to tackle. And I wonder how much of it, like pretty much as you said, is an internet-specific question, and how much of it is a purely economic question that has consequences over the internet. What I mean is basically, when you study investment flows or trade flows, what you see is that they're heavily biased in a cultural sense and also in an institutional sense. So people trade with people whom they trust, basically. How much what we see here is basically the mere reflection of that over the internet, and should it be treated in a different way because it's the internet? Not quite sure about that. So basically what Ethan says is that there is some kind of public goods value of that space that we all share, so that there are like some kind of externalities whereby like I go there and everybody benefits from it in some way. And if that's the case, then we need regulations on top to force private companies to open up the network, think in different ways. this is a really challenging issue. If we're not really willing to do that, I'm not sure this is an internet-specific question. It's just like, basically, how do you ensure trust in those countries? And that's a business practice. And the welfare consequences of that for society at large are kind of difficult to assess to me. So I have no answers here. Those are very deep questions for me.
I mean, there is something to add to it, because I see this in kind of the Western view of Africa is, I think a lot actually about the question of trust in trade in places like Ghana. I actually have done work on mobile phone use and like the fishing industry and farming and trade, and like, you know, how do people kind of expand their network of people they sell their produce to? And often those questions come down to questions of trust. But I think there's a complicating element here, which is just media imagery about Africa and how that continues to portray Africa in a particular way that makes it more difficult for Western countries to invest in African countries, unnecessarily so. It's not a purely rational, economically driven assessment. It's partly media imagery and partly a sort of emerging bias that's grounded in that. So I'm just throwing that in there to kind of complicate things against this kind of economically rational analysis.
Okay, a comment and a question. Like in sort of the network security space, it's pretty much every conference I've gone to, there's always been this thread about security people saying management doesn't take security seriously enough, doesn't give us the resources, doesn't give us the priority. So, I mean, I haven't heard people at those conferences specifically suggesting country level blocks, but I can kind of sort of see from a budgetary standpoint, they might do what they feel like they have the resources to do. And the question was, like, if you had the opportunity to sit down with the CEOs of one of these companies and just try and make the case for, you know, Amazon or Match.com opening up to African countries, how would you do it? Would you sort of say there's, you know, just a moral obligation, or would you sort of say that there's sort of an untapped economic potential there?
Well, I probably wouldn't take the it's a moral obligation argument with the CEO of a company. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've been in the corporate sector where, you know, it's kind of depressing because recurringly there's like, oh, Africa's the new market. You know, Google has a project, Intel has a project. And then that interest seems to die down so quickly. It's like a cycle. I've seen this cycle many times. I'm glad I'm not in industry trying to do Africa because the attention span is so short. But there is, I mean, that does seem to be an argument that floats with corporate execs, that there's a legitimate market there. And I mean, there's trade coming into Ghana, into Nigeria. There are people buying things all the time. Certainly a subscription to Match.com is not beyond the realm of possibility for many, many Ghanaians and Nigerians. I don't think that's what's blocking Match.com from allowing access from those countries, but.
One specific example on that, Fast Company put out yesterday their list of 25 most interesting technology companies. Number 7 on that list is a company called Sproxel. And Sproxel is a Ghanaian company. It's run by a Ghanaian founder who happens to be based in Cambridge. And it does pharma security, basically. So anti-counterfeiting of drugs. This is a massive problem in the developing world. You walk into a Nigerian pharmacy and 50% of the product on the shelf is fake. And so this is a system that has a number that you can enter into a mobile phone, check back, and find out whether the factory verifies this is a legitimate product. I've had the great pleasure of advising this company for about 5 years, and they have a very interesting problem. They can raise this much money from the yay raw Africa investors who are really psyched to give $500,000 to an entrepreneurial African. But when they go to raise the $5 million, everybody says, 70% of your revenues are in Nigeria. Hmm. What if Nigeria no longer functions as a market? What if we can no longer make money in Nigeria? We can't possibly invest in you. There's too much risk. Hmm. Well, the interesting thing is this is a company that actually does really well in risky markets. It exists specifically
because
there is a legal shortcoming. And so it's working really, really well in some of the most dangerous markets in the world. And the company is profitable in Nigeria, but is still having enormous difficulty with this. So I want to I'm not scared to make the moral argument about this, and I will at some point, whether it's offline or online, but there is a perceptions piece of this that gets very, very complicated, where people's understanding of risk in these environments may not be an accurate reflection of what the actual risk is, and may have a lot to do with the portrayals.
But would you make the moral argument to a CEO you're trying to convince to invest $5 million?
So this was going to be my closing comment, but I won't use it as a closing comment because there's at least two other hands up here. But I had the great joy of speaking to Mog. And does anyone here know what Mog is? Mog is the most important group that you've never heard of. It's the Messaging Anti-Abuse Working Group. It is a secret society of sysadmins and all sorts of mail administrators who are trying to wipe out spam and phishing and so on and so forth. If you work for a major e-commerce site and you are involved with things like trying to figure out how to deal with the spam or a spear phishing problem, you are almost certainly part of Mog. And I had the great pleasure of coming and addressing them about 2 years ago on exactly this topic, instead of coming in and saying, look, I know we've all gotten to the point where we just want to shut off email to Vietnam. Like, I get it, but you can't do it, and here's why you can't do it. You know, look at the Arab Spring, look at the role that networks have had in these places. These apparently expedient solutions have enormous implications as far as sort of cutting people off of networks. And the approach that worked was saying to the sort of folks here, look, we get it. Your job is to protect your systems, but your other job is to protect an open functioning internet. And with the folks who were sort of working in the trenches of these companies, that was actually something that had an enormous resonance for them if it had not been something that... So, no, I totally think it's plausible. And I think what you're really saying is not don't filter out fraud. What you're saying is don't use stupid, blunt tools because they're going to cut you off of markets that actually matter. Don't get tied up in what your perception of these countries actually are versus what these countries are. Make sure that you're actually blocking real bad behavior rather than sort of generalizing from a pattern of bad behavior. Question?
I was just going to ask if it's sensible to include Amazon dating sites and West Elm all in the same package, that somebody like Amazon or West Elm might have other issues with countries from the third or second world that a dating site might not. For example, a postal service that can be relied on to deliver, or even the same cultural practices in regards to purchasing and returns that might make doing business in a second or third world country prohibitive for other reasons.
There is a commonality, which is that they're all facing different kinds of scamming. Actual scams.
I'm talking purely on infrastructure. For example, the ability to get a package delivered reliably might be as much of a block for somebody like Amazon or West Elm as fraud.
Right.
The problem might be different than the one that you're focusing on
for
those companies.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say, like I said before, there is a common scamming practice. I mean, they're credit card fraudsters. Certainly West Elm is concerned about credit card fraudsters, people manipulating the e-commerce system. So is Amazon. The dating websites, I think, are very distinct because you're talking about people doing this kind of social engineering form of scamming. So dating websites are trying to protect their privileged users from being, you know, manipulated and made to fall for a scheme by someone who's a less preferred user, right? So there's not credit card fraud. I mean, maybe Match.com, but a lot of these sites are free. Like PlentyOfFish.com is free. But it's the social engineering strategies that they're trying to block to protect the users that are considered their important base. I don't like the word primitive in reference to countries like Ghana. But I don't know how much shipping or mail is a problem. I mean, you can certainly ship things to Ghana. I mean, I've had stuff shipped by DHL. People have postal, they may not have street addresses and house numbers, but everyone I know has a post office box. Services like FedEx and UPS, they all operate in Ghana and Nigeria. that to me seems like, just from my basic experience, not to be the major blockage or barrier. And, you know, one thing, I think actually seeing how some of these scams have unfolded, not shipping to Ghana and Nigeria is also a way of blocking scams. So, so what ends up happening is that scammers have to kind of get in cahoots if they want to get things shipped using credit card fraud. They have to get in cahoots with someone in a country that can receive shipments. And that's just an extra laborious step that will cut down on a certain amount of scamming, right? So you have Ghanaian scammers who partner with people they met on Yahoo chat rooms in the U.S. to receive and then redirect shipments from sites like Amazon.com. So it's continuous with that credit card fraud practice, preventing it.
Last question.
Just to build off what Kendra and Ethan have said, I think that network security is the network security is what leads to the access problem. But what I think that your where your research is so valuable is to application access issues. And Josephine Wolf at MIT did a great paper for TPRC this year and talks about how if you take security out of the network layer, which is this either anonymous or accountable system, and you put it in the application layer, then it really relies on these user behavior things, which I think is where your work could contribute so much to having great security from these countries that we don't have a lot of understanding for a user behavior. So a lot of the examples she uses are people invest in a lot in Wikipedia and Yelp and virtual worlds, and they get sort of benefits from that. They have a really good understanding of how their users are trustworthy or not. And that's cultural though, right? So they can't right. just move that into these other countries. But if they could, I think that would, then you could go into the CEO and say, I'm not making a moral argument. I'm sort of, I have a proposition for you that if you understand these users, you really can provide accountable systems.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually that was one sort of point that I had as an end point in my talk. I've been reading articles. I have a first degree in computer science. So I've been going back and reading articles on network security and machine learning, and kind of a theme that I'm seeing in what I've read so far, which is very minimal, is this assumption that we can, if we're experienced network administrators, we can identify scams and spam when we see it. And the challenge is automating that. And I actually think it's way more complicated now. I think an experienced network administrator who's seen a lot of things may no longer be able to distinguish between illegitimate and legitimate behavior based on kind of patterns of interaction. Because it's gets in this really complicated realm of kind of cultural practices.
Mm-hmm. So we have exceeded our hard stop here. So we're going to chase folks out. But before we do, if we could just get a round of applause.